I went into a depression that lasted several years. And this is even hard to explain because overnight I lost my ward family, 350 families. None of them reached out to me. I'm living here. I see them all out my window. Every window I look, there are people that I coached lacrosse with for 8 years, that I served on the bishopric for years, and the high priest group leader. I served side by side with them 20, 30 hours a week for 10 years. I've never heard from them since then. They live seven houses away. Seven houses. I thought we were friends. I thought we had a relationship, a true relationship.
On today's episode, I connect with Brian Accord, who hosts the podcast Strangers You Know. Brian shares a story of growing up in a closed-loop society surrounded by Mormons, where everyone he knew was a church member. From elementary to high school, he couldn't recall anyone who wasn't LDS. And as someone who didn't fully believe in the church, Brian went on to pursue college and he joined a fraternity. However, after being inspired by his friend's missionary letters, he decided to go on his own 2-year mission to Japan. For years after his mission, he served more and more in the church until eventually he began to explore different perspectives and ways of thinking. Spoiler alert, Brian is no longer a member of the church. In this episode, Brian takes us on a journey through his life, sharing his experiences and struggles with a high-demand religion. He describes how he uses his podcast to break down barriers and encourage people to be open to new perspectives, even if they may challenge his beliefs. This was such an interesting conversation to have, especially for someone like me who's not connected to an organized religion and never really has been. I hope you enjoy the perspectives that we shared in this conversation. I'd like to give a big thank you to Mickey, Tracy, and Emily for sponsoring 2 episodes of the show each month. The Patreon really allows me to try new software, upgrade hardware, and continue bringing these important stories to the public. So thank you. Information about the Patreon can be found in the show notes for this episode. And with that, I'm happy to share this new episode of the Life Shift podcast with my guest, Brian Accord. I'm Matt Gilhooly, and this is The Life Shift, candid conversations about the pivotal moments that have changed lives forever. Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Life Shift podcast. I am here with a fellow podcaster and friend, Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Matt.
Thank you for being a part of this. I know we've been talking for a while about having you on the show, and for some reason, my emails never make them to you. So I'm glad we were able to make this happen. And I think your story is going to be a really interesting one for me, selfishly. I think this will be a learning lesson for me. But I think there are other people out there that have gone through similar situations or are on the edge of going through, and maybe they happen to come across this podcast if they're allowed. So thank you for being a part of this and being willing to share your story. I know you do this on your podcast, which is called Strangers You Know, and you have some really deep conversations about deconstructing a lot of parts of life, right? Would you want to tell us a little bit about that podcast just so we have an idea?
So it kind of came about because of my story. So we're not going to get into the ends of it yet. It basically came down to the idea that we live in a closed loop society with our social media, and everybody you see on your social news feed, because of the algorithm, it only shows you people that look like you, talk like you, think like you, grew up with the same backgrounds. And you hear that enough and people think, you see other people say, what are their problems? What are they thinking? Why do they make this? It's like, those are all good questions. Can we take a second and go ask them and then listen to their response? That's kind of what the Strangers You Know is. I like to introduce my listeners to people from all walks of life and just sit down and see the world through their eyes for a minute.
And probably uncover that the human experience has a lot more commonalities than differences,
for sure.
I would imagine. And
yeah,
you know, here on this show, the same feelings I get from having conversations with people, even though their experiences are quite different, there's a lot of common emotions, common feelings towards things and humanity in general that I find is very refreshing to your point of the closed loop society and the things that we are either forced to gravitate towards because of the algorithms or things we naturally gravitate towards because we don't like to be uncomfortable in some cases, or some people don't like to be uncomfortable. So I think what you're doing, some of those conversations are really fascinating that you have with your guests. So thank you for putting that out into the world.
Oh yeah, no, it's, I love it because it allows me to get outside my comfort zone, and people that already know what I know and think what I think. And I think one of the biggest benefits for me is once you meet one of these individuals, I interviewed a 31-year-old homeless man named Silence. And everybody has preconceived notions about homeless people, and they don't have many opportunities to sit down and talk with one. And once you hear Silence's story, you never look at another homeless person the same way again. You just have that more humanity, more like, wow, they are this close to my life. You know, they were so very close. That could be me instead of that person. And what an amazing individual that person is. And it's like, why wouldn't they be? Just because their life is different, they have to be less than or worse or wrong. Yeah, I don't buy that.
I would agree. Yeah. And you know what? I think in a lot of the conversations I have, we talk about how, I don't know who it was, but maybe like society has taught us to judge others in some way. And maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just something that has been passed down without intention. But I think that is a great example, that guest that you had, of just like, they're people too. You know, they're in different circumstances that maybe we can't understand, but maybe if we sat down with the strangers we know and have a conversation with them, that segues perfectly into what you're going to share, because I think that there are people that will understand your situation. And then there'll be people like me that are like, I don't get it. You know, I don't understand. So before we get to that very specific trigger, pivotal moment that really has changed the trajectory of your life, why don't you kind of set the scene or paint the picture of what your life was leading up to this moment? And you can go back as far as you need to really give us that good picture.
Okay. Well, so I was born and raised in a suburb in Salt Lake City, Utah, surrounded by Mormons. If you haven't lived in two counties in Salt Lake, you may not be aware of what it means to be surrounded by Mormons. I'll try to give you a little bit of an idea of that. So I think all through elementary, I can't think of a single person that I went to school with, teacher or student, that wasn't LDS. Now, there might have been someone, but they were probably feeling out of it and never let that be known. They just kind of quietly slid by. But literally, every kid you played with on recess, anything you were doing on Sunday had to be church related because that's where all the kids were. They don't play sports on Sunday. Actually, church sports was even bigger than city baseball or whatever. The church volleyball and church basketball was much, much bigger because everybody belonged to that same church, with the exception of my family, right? So I grew up pseudo in the church. My grandparents on both my mother and my father's side go generations and generations back to the beginning of the church. We had pioneers that walked across the United States pushing a hand cart. We had polygamy on both sides of the family. We had missionaries. My great-great-grandfather, my great-great-great-grandfather went on church missions all the way back to the beginning, but not my parents. My mom was baptized. My grandfather was baptized on my dad's side, but he married a Catholic. And so he kind of like, religion wasn't his thing. So he just kind of did everything Catholic. So my dad was never baptized. And so some of the few people that I knew in my family, we had a very close family. My family was one of the few people that I knew that drank coffee or alcohol or smoked. Almost, you don't see that anywhere in the neighborhood. It's kind of crazy.
You were the outliers.
We were the outliers for sure.
Did you feel that way?
Not so much, but one of the things, and this comes back to play later, is I met a lot of members in the church think drinking coffee is terrible. I mean, it's one of the worst things you can do, you know, next to, you know, murder and rape and, you know, all, there are a lot of other things you can do that are worse than drinking coffee, right? But they're all the same. Drinking coffee, alcohol, smoking, not going to church on Sunday, not paying your tithing, not dressing appropriately, not all of this is the worst thing you can do. The people that I knew that were doing it, my family members, they're good people. Both sets of grandparents, my aunts and my uncles that weren't in the church, and they're just wonderful people. They drink coffee. On occasion, they drink alcohol. And I had a few that smoked once in a while, and I didn't think much of it at the time. I just kind of, you know, they're good people regardless. But I didn't really believe in the church. I went to church because that's where my friends were on Sunday. Flash forward a couple of years when I graduate. I go off to college. I join a fraternity. I'm drinking some alcohol. I'm enjoying life a little bit. Tangentially related to the church. But growing up, the leaders would always say, they'd always check, are you thinking of going on a mission? And I'm like, yes. In the back of my head, finish the sentence. I'm thinking there is no way you're going to convince me to give 2 years of my life to go on a mission. But I just cut it off at yes. So no plans of doing that. That wasn't me. All my friends went. And I wrote, at the time, they were allowed to write one letter home a week. And on one day a week, they could write letters. And a lot of them wrote to me. And that had an effect. I was dating a lady that became my wife. She kind of wanted to marry a return missionary. It was kind of a big thing for her. She didn't really push. She says now she dragged me into the church. I'm not sure that was entirely the case, but whatever reason, I'm living in the fraternity. I've got, my bedroom is the size of a shoebox. And for some reason at this time, my scriptures were there that my mom gave me when I was a sophomore. I'd moved several times. I have no idea why I had my scriptures there. I started to read them. Can't remember why. Stopped drinking. Someone handed me a drink and I said, yeah, I don't drink anymore. They're like, since when? And I'm like, since when? I didn't realize that. I get this idea that I'm going to go on a mission. And all my friends are coming home. And I turn, because you usually go, the men usually go out at 19. And I turned 21 my last Saturday in the United States in the Mission Training Center in Provo before I went on my 2-year mission to Japan.
Did you feel that those letters that were coming to you were targeted to you to get you to try or want to go on a mission?
I don't think there was any of that. I think they were saying how great it was for them and the lives that they're influencing. I don't think that's, and they were friends. They were just friends telling me about their life and they were excited. I mean, I had a friend that lived in Guatemala. He lived in the jungles of Guatemala. That was totally his mission. Indiana Jones stuff, machete on his hip, scriptures on the other one. You know, it's kind of, that kind of sounded neat.
The skeptic in me of just organized religion in general, my thought goes to, they were asked to send you the letters to convince you to go. And then your girlfriend, now wife, was also coming from this end. And so you were like, oh, gotta go. I've been pressured into it. But doesn't sound like it was the case.
I didn't feel pressured into it. I feel like I stepped into it. Even okay. With my wife and my friends, I feel like this is something I started studying church history. It started to make sense to me. It was the first time I ever really studied. I went to church and primary and Sunday school and young men's and all that, but it really started to make sense. And I'm like, no, this is it.
Really?
This is really, and everybody that I was surrounded by that were good, everybody that I was surrounded by, they were all members of the church, even the people in the fraternity. The people that I was drawn to members of the fraternity that came from outside of the state or they weren't members of the church, the things that I was drawn to about them were very Mormon-esque.
In what way?
Very high sense of values. They weren't partiers. They had a strong sense of community. And for some reason in my brain, that all resonated, that's kind of what the church is about. That's what people in the church have that. And there are people outside the church that have that. But there's always this like little resonating sound that like they'd be better if they were members. If all they need to do is be baptized and they'd be the most wonderful person. I'm thinking, why would they have to be baptized to do that? They're already amazing people. Can't that just be enough?
Do you think that like just a byproduct of consistently going to church with your friends as part of that was just kind of like drip, drip,
yes.
Like it puts that idea in your head that's the only way.
Yes.
I mean, even though you see it, the only way to get to that level is being baptized in the church and following all the rules.
The second part, following all the rules. You don't just get baptized and say, salvation, hallelujah. You have to do all of the things. And there are so many things. Everyone needs to marry a return missionary. Everyone has to get married in the temple. Everyone has to, all of these things. You can't drink coffee. You must read your scriptures daily, personal and companion and family scripture study. And all these good examples that you're shown all came inside the church. And all these bad examples, people point out, they are outside the church or they have left the church. They used to be here, but now they're struggling with addiction. You don't hear about the people that are inside the church that are struggling with addiction. You don't hear about the people that are outside the church that have never been addicted. It's always the messages you get support the belief system and the structure. And so yeah, I went to Japan for 2 years and was converting very few people. There, not a lot of interest in Christianity, certainly not Mormonism.
On that mission, I'm just so curious to me, and I've never really investigated or thought about it. And so when you're on that mission, like, what is a typical week like? Like, or what are you assigned to do for a week?
Yeah, so you do a lot of finding, knocking on doors, hanging out in the parks, talking with people wherever, just starting up whatever conversations, visiting some members, asking if they know anybody that are interested in taking the discussions. We taught free English classes at the church. And of course, we teach it at the church and people came here. What's this building? It's a good opener. Let me tell you about the building. And I don't feel like I ever pushed it on them, but if they showed any inkling at all, we were going to start teaching them discussions. And we could still teach them English one way or the other, but there are very strict, the strictest of guidelines go to missionaries. And we have this little white handbook that you carry around and underline and go backwards and forwards. And you're up at 6. It tells you every minute of the day what you're doing until you go back to bed at 10:30. How much study time, what you're studying. They give you the manuals. They tell you what time you leave the apartment. They tell you how you have all these rules. And it's like a soldier, right? There's not like, well, you just join the army and then just kind of go do things. No, you're here. You do it all the time. We transfer you. You're always with a companion. You're right home once a week.
Were you all in? Were you like 100% like, oh, this makes sense to me. I should definitely should follow this because was that drive because you knew that was the only way that you were going to end up where everyone promises you end up?
The celestial kingdom. Okay. Absolutely.
So it's like, I can't get out of line.
Yeah, there are 3 degrees of glory and there's no shortcuts. And the Japanese have a saying that says there are many ways to the top of Mount Fuji. And I used to say, no. There's one God. There's one heaven. There's one path to get there. I don't believe that anymore. But everybody has their own path. That idea just seems so hokey. It's like, oh, that's so flimsy. That's just, oh, we can just do whatever we want and nothing really matters. Just be a good person and everything will be fine. No, there's a path. There's a destination. And they'll show you every step you take to get there.
And as a missionary, did you have like a quota? I mean, that's a silly question, but were you required to convert?
We set goals. We were asked to set goals. And it's very much, there's a reason why all the multi-level marketing companies are based in Utah. That it's multi-level marketing for Mormons. You come back and change it to Sensi or to whatever else you've got. Whatever, they're all right there in Mormon Central. That's all of the multi-level marketing. You got to build your downline, right? Got to get baptisms. How do you get that? You teach lessons. How do you teach lessons? You find people. How many people are we going to find this week? How many lessons are we going to teach this week? How many baptisms are we going to have? And you just kind of set that base. And we didn't have a lot of baptisms in Japan, but it's all very sales based. And there's the path, there's the process. Lesson one, you start with lesson one and it's taught a certain way. And lesson two, and it's a certain way.
And you were all in.
I was all in. I mean, so consider, I left the middle of my fraternity, halfway through my college, all of my friends at the fraternity, they don't know what to think of me all of a sudden. Now all of a sudden I'm Mormon.
Yeah, because you were just kind of like a pseudo-Mormon up until
that point.
I
wasn't at all. There were some people at the fraternity that were shocked when they found out that I was going on a mission because I didn't know you were LDS. I didn't know you were LDS. Yeah, surprise. Turns out I am.
Is that I don't know. This is going to sound really ignorant. But no. Is because there's a lineage of fundamentalist Mormons in your family, is there like a legacy that you like you're automatically in?
Most Mormons are baptized at the age of 8 is when they choose to get baptized. What are you choosing at the age of 8?
What your favorite candy is?
Exactly. And when you get baptized, you get candy. Okay, so I come back from my mission. 2 years left all of my family. We get 2 phone calls a year. One on Christmas and one on Mother's Day. Those are the only time you can call home. Everything else is letters, one day a week. And that one day is also when you do all of your shopping, all of your laundry, all of your anything, your bike maintenance, whatever. It's done on those 8 hours, 6 hours, really, on your P day. And the rest of the time, you are out either studying or teaching, or it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Do you get paid?
Nothing. You pay your own way.
Oh, great.
You save up money so you can buy your flight over.
To Japan.
To Japan. Yeah, which is one of the most expensive missions in the world at the time. And I had a unique experience because of that. Because it was so expensive, Japan is one of the few missions that has four missionaries in the apartment. Most of the places you go around the world, there are two. And you're with your companion 24/7 for up to 3-6 months. If you don't like that person, you literally have no one else to talk to. You're living in the jungles with that guy for 3 months. And you don't, anyway, so yeah, that's some dedication, right? I mean, that's just, it's crazy.
It's interesting that you either, you know, I could understand if you didn't get paid, but if they paid your way, that would make more sense to me, or some kind of incentive to do it. But I guess if what you're sold as the end goal is, you know, where you're going to end up when everything is done here on Earth, I guess that is, you're paying to get into that. So you did that for 2 years and you came back and
transferred down to BYU. So doubled down. And so that kind of becomes the theme for the next several years, is I just kept getting further and further. And there were times where we were a little less active, where we went to like half the meetings on Sunday. You know, we didn't like ever miss like two Sundays in a row. That's just crazy thinking.
You felt like a rebel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was just dirty, just less than human. And so my wife at the same time, because I went later, at that time, women went on their missions when they were 21. And they only stayed out for 18 months. So she went on a mission to Germany while I was in Japan. I got home in August. She got home in September. We were married in January, which is probably the best decision I've ever made. Still really young, still really fast. We dated long enough when we got home to realize we're the same person. Because, you know, people change in 2 years when you haven't talked with them.
And you're off saving people.
You're off saving people. Yeah. We got married, both went to BYU. A couple years later, we started having kids like we're supposed to. Oh, so we were married in the temple, which means my parents couldn't go to my wedding.
Oh, because they're not card carrying.
Because they're not allowed in the temple. They're not card carrying, right? And so my sisters and my brother, they couldn't go. So half the family stays outside, which is a real shitty thing to do.
They just stay outside on the steps? Or are they allowed on the property?
There's a little waiting room indoors. But then you take the celebration outside and whatever. But it kind of became my family, my identity. We moved out of state to go back to grad school. And nice thing about it is everywhere you move, you can meet the Mormons. They're all right there. You find your new ward. You have immediate friends and connections to the community. They can show you where to shop and all of the good stuff. So that's kind of a nice connection anywhere around the world, whether you're visiting or whatever. You move in, you the first Sunday, you know, you have family.
Yeah. You find your closed loop.
You find your closed loop. Exactly. Get you right back into that. Exactly. So I went to grad school, went to Orlando, worked down there for a little bit, but the church kind of becomes your identity. While we're outside of the state, it certainly became our family. And we're as close family can be. Everybody knew everybody's birthday. We got together 3 or 4 times a week for all kinds of social reasons, all day along on Sundays. Everybody has a calling. It's not paid. So everybody has some function, some role to fill within the church. You're never allowed to think that if the church, you pick the parts that work for you. In the high demand religion, you are all in, accepting all of it, or you're not in at all. And so when you're living out in the mission field, like outside of Utah, they call that the mission field. So when we lived in Virginia and Florida, there weren't really any Jack Mormons or partial Mormons. They were either all in or they weren't. Nobody even knew who they were. If you didn't want to be in the church, don't. But in Utah, you really never had that. So Jack Mormons, you had to pretend, because, I mean, the ward that I live in now, it's 3 blocks long by 2 blocks. There are 350 houses in here. When we moved in and when I was very active, there were, I could count on one hand the number of houses that weren't LDS. Think about that. Three blocks by two blocks, all but five houses, 350 houses, five of them were not LDS. The church buildings here outnumber the gas stations 5-1. And there are three wards that meet in every one of those buildings. They have three different meeting times so they can go through all three of their meetings every Sunday.
So I'm assuming there's like a kind of like a magnet in each state or each city. Like you're kind of like drawn towards that closed loop group.
Yeah, they have boundaries and there are the smaller wards, and then they have a stake that is over that, and then they have an area. And so they have leaders at all these different levels that manage different things. So
in Utah, is the land owned by the church that people live on, or is it
no, kinda like, okay. just the buildings, so, which there are a lot of them.
Right. But the church is only, not like people's houses and stuff like that.
No.
Okay.
No. So fast forward again, we had all of our kids. We became pillars of the ward. We moved back here in 2000. My youngest daughter was born here. We have four kids. So she was born just as we moved back in. So we lived in Virginia for a little bit, lived in Florida for a bit, moved back here at 2000. And I've lived in this house since 2000. My daughter was born while we lived here, and she's about to graduate college. So this is our family, this local 350 houses, that's our ward. And I keep doubling down, and I keep getting a higher level of callings. And so I've been in this ward, and I know every family that moves in and out. You meet them the day they move in. You help them the day they move out. I mean, you know everything about everybody. You're probably the people that you serve with in my callings. I served in a couple of bishoprics. I was the high priest group leader for 7 years. And so you get to know a lot of these different areas. And I kept doubling down and keep getting deeper and deeper into the church. All four of my kids graduated from seminary, which is it's like a seminary, but you go all through junior high and high school. They have a separate building that's just barely off campus, but right next to every junior high and high school. And they take one class a day to go over to seminary and study Mormonism. And of course, there are kids that don't do that, but they're kind of on the outs. But you can tell because they show their shoulders when they dress, if they're girls, or they get there, have more than one piercing in their ear, you know, or...
They're not going to that celestial kingdom at the end. No, not with that.
No, they're riding their skateboard on Sunday, or they're just throwing frisbee in the park. I mean, straight to hell.
Let me ask you about the callings. Is that an assigned? Is that like something that they're like, this is what you need to do, and you're told what your calling is? Or is that?
Yeah, so you get asked, you get extended a calling. And as a member, when I was in the bishopric, we extended 10 callings a week, even to the youth. Like, so they have these little group, the youth, the ward, the young men and young women have their own group. They're broken out by age. Each one of them has a class presidency, kind of like a bishopric, kind of like a stake presidency, kind of like the first presidency and the prophet of the church and the first area presidency. It's all the same structure, just repeated on a micro level. So you get the young men and the young women lead the young women's group, and the young men lead the young men's group, and there are four people that run each group. So almost everybody has a leadership role at some point throughout the youth. And then the adults oversee that. And then there are the bishopric oversees the whole ward. And a lot of them are, I wouldn't say made up callings, because people make them really busy, but they have a primary chorister, and they have someone that leads music in sacrament, and that's their only role. And then all of the teachers and the young men that and out here, the young men's program was synonymous with scouting. If you were in the young men's program, you were also a scout.
Can you say no to the calling suggestion?
You can. Most people don't. I never did. Most people I know never did.
Fear of saying no?
It's not the fear of saying no. It's like, this is what God must want.
Got it.
Because God has led the bishop to ask me to serve in this capacity.
Okay.
And I want to do something. Everybody has a calling. You can't just say no and sit back and crack open a beer and enjoy your Sunday. That's never going to happen.
Or coffee.
Yeah. Or energy drinks. Or, yeah.
Yeah. So you were kind of leading the charge.
I was leading the charge.
Suggesting the callings.
I was giving the callings. I was lining up all of the meetings. We were planning for camps. We were doing all this stuff. I mean, honestly, in the bishopric, it probably takes... On an average week, it takes probably 20 to 25 hours on an average week.
And that's on top of just like your normal life?
Life. You got a job. And I coached hockey and I coached lacrosse and I had a family. But there were some people that were so involved, and some say that it's by design. I've had several people that I've talked with that said, I never knew my dad. my dad belonged to the church. He was the bishop. He was the stake president. He was everybody else's dad. I never saw him. I never had a relationship with my dad the whole time growing up because he was a good, stalwart Mormon fulfilling his callings and doing a lot of good and wonderful people. But his own daughter feels like I never even knew him. He was that busy. So you don't have friends outside of that. You don't get to spend time with your family. All your time is here. This is everything.
It's by design.
So now we're kind of getting to my shift.
Yeah, let's get you there.
So I'm in this bishopric and I'm serving. It's probably my 10th straight year in a very visible leadership position. And when I look back on it, people say, well, when did it start for you? I look back on it and see instances of it 3 years before or even more. Even before I was in my last bishopric, when I was a high priest group leader, this thing started to bother me. So you've got the first two commandments, which is love God and love your neighbor. I totally buy into the love your neighbor. I'm not sure why we have a commandment that we have to love God. Does he need us to love him? Is us being a good person our way of showing love to God? I never quite could figure out the first one. But two is love your neighbor. I'm all down with that. And then you get into like the Ten Commandments, and then you get into what the prophet is currently teaching and all of the doctrine and the white handbook for the missionaries and the stake presidency handbook, and the bishopric has their own handbook, and the youth have their own handbook, and all the way down to the very end. And so 4 times a year, the young women have to be taught about modest clothing, that they can't have spaghetti straps, they can't show their shoulders, they can only have one piercing in each ear, and then that's it. And I'm like, have we really nailed the love your neighbor part? Because looking around, it doesn't feel like we've really nailed that. But we're really set on something clear at the other end of the spectrum. We're making sure that anytime somebody wears a prom dress, it's commented on, oh, what a modest dress you have. You had such a modest dress. You had such a modest dress. You, I hope you had fun. But I did see your shoulders in your prom dress, so you're probably going to hell. And she's not thinking that. She's 15 or 16, and she's thinking, I liked the color. I mean, I just...
And so your life was... I mean, that neighbor part is interesting to me, too. Is it love your Mormon neighbor, or is it love all neighbors?
Well, so the church would say it's everybody. But you don't really know anybody else. You don't have enough time to know anybody else. So the love your neighbor part, I started saying when I was in the bishopric, this had been bothering me for so long. We should give every calling we ever get, or every assignment we ever give to talk, or every lesson we ever assign to teach, should be, your assignment is to give a talk on love your neighbor through modest dressing, through dressing modestly. Let's start everything with love your neighbor until let's make sure that that's why we're doing all of this. And if we can't find a way for whatever this small little topic is to fit into love your neighbor, let's not do it. And I really kind of got on that horse for a bit and was really started pushing that. And everybody's like, okay, that's kind of all right. Nobody else really said anything. They didn't act like there was anything wrong with it. I think they just kind of felt this fell outside of the manual, right? Nobody's ever said this. None of the prophets have ever said, we have a ton of training for leaders and nobody's ever talked about this. So that was kind of my first thing.
And that was like 3 years of that?
Yeah. It was probably 3 years of just kind of, yeah, there was something there that didn't bother me. And then I noticed that the leaders, especially the prophets, the first presidency, Jeffrey R. Holland had a talk specifically where he mentioned we need to take up, he's telling the membership, we need to defend the family proclamation. And if necessary, and he uses figuratively, taking up the musket to defend the family system.
What does that mean?
And that just immediately hit me wrong for a number of reasons. One, they had several shootings inside of LGBTQ nightclubs and whatever. So the idea of taking up a musket for anything is just atrocious. Second, a musket is not a weapon of defense, right? That would be a shield. That would be saying your prayers. That is a weapon of attack that you're suggesting. Even if it's just figuratively, it's still, and thirdly, the LGBTQ community, they're not attacking you. They're just being themselves. You're seeing it as an attack because you're so homophobic that it's ridiculous.
Right. It doesn't fit into your mold.
Yes. And And this was a leader that I used to love. He was always the most heartwarming and friendly and genuine person. And I'm like, not you. You're not the lawyer that's demanding the letter of the law that's talking about Old Testament crap. You're the loving one. You're telling us to take up arms against the LGBTQ community. I happen to know several people in there, and they're really good people. As a matter of fact, the first one became my very first conversation on my podcast was Jackson. I had coached him in lacrosse for a number of years until he came out, and I have lunches with him, and he was telling me his story, and I'm like, people need to hear how hard this has been for you. He's going on a mission. He's queer. he's trans. He has his patriarchal blessing and everything that he knows that would make his parents happy and the church, and he was going to BYU. And it was just the conflict that was going on in his head. It's like, I don't think people realize what they go through. So that became the last thing. And I did the complete unthinkable. I asked to be released from that calling.
And from that statement, just like, this is what we need to
from
do.
All of, and like, that's kind of what it was, is I didn't know what was going on at the time with me. I just know I can't carry the water for an organization that says to defend the family by taking up muskets figuratively against this LGBTQ community or any community.
Because of love your neighbor.
What, love your neighbor? How is that loving your neighbor? It is the antithesis of loving your neighbor.
Well, we know what it means. We know that love your neighbor means love the people like you that are following the same rules as you.
But I don't even think that's what scholars of the scriptures would say that was intended. But yet that's the way. And so I fell into this depression. I had several people that I mentioned that I knew that were LGBTQ, that were queer. And one of them grew up in our neighborhood. His dad is the nicest person you'll ever meet, but is also towing the line as bishop and stake president. Just the sweetest, kindest, most loving individual. And his son came out as gay and got married. And I just remember thinking, if God has a problem with Adam, that God is an asshole. I don't want to have anything to do with that God. Adam is his son is just like his dad, the most loving, wonderful human being you could ever meet. And we're taking up muskets against Adam, against Jackson, against, this can't be it. And I won't get into all of the truth claims, because I started doing some more research and figured out all these things, why the church can't be true and all of these things that are out there. There are other websites to talk about that, but I went into a depression that lasted several years. And this is even hard to explain, because overnight I lost my ward family, 350 families. None of them reached out to me. I'm living here. I see them all out my window. Every window I look, and there are people that I coached lacrosse with for 8 years, that I served on the bishopric for years, and the high priest group leader. I served side by side with them 20, 30 hours a week for 10 years. I've never heard from them since then. They live seven houses away. Seven houses.
And you probably see them.
I thought we were friends. I thought we had a relationship, a true relationship. It was all the church. And I don't believe that. So you make up stories in your head, right? How do you explain that? I'm a pariah here, and I get I'm the one that left. I get they don't understand that. I get that they don't have that same experience. But was there nothing that carried over?
Well, I think that, I mean, unfortunately, tells you other things that probably led you into other research and whatnot. But I'm curious, before you go into that depression piece, when you decline the calling or whatever the terminology is, at that moment, is that just cutting the cord, or is that you kind of stepping down? Does that make you a pariah in that space by what you chose to do?
I don't think that in and of itself would have.
Okay.
I have been, like I said, I have been serving 30, 40 hours a week for a decade plus, and coaching, which is another 30 hours a week, and my job and my family, and I think people would have understood that. But I also no longer felt comfortable going to the church. And I started to hear little daggers of releases from the prophet, talks that were given across the pulpit, little things friends would say on social media, would just really just hit me so hard. And they just became such triggers. And I'm like, I had no intention of walking away from the church. I just said, I can't do this anymore right now. I can't sit here and be expected to meet with a young man or young woman or grown adult and have them tell me that they may be queer, knowing that my role is to follow the handbook that says, well, you need to pray. You need to study your scriptures. I'm like, that is not what they need. They need someone to say, I love you. What can I do to help? And they're not going to get that here. And me staying here is a sign that of who I am to them. And I don't want to be that person. And then it also hit me, how many times in the past decades have I been that person and not even realized it? And that hurt. How many times when someone came to me who just needed some help and wanted someone to listen and accept them for who they are and love them as their neighbor, and I gave them some bullshit statement about accepting a calling or studying their scriptures or being more diligent in this, that, or the other. And I'm like, that started to weigh on me more than anything. And then the truth claims came in, but that wasn't really it for me. The biggest problem became I didn't know who I was. So several times on your show, I've heard people talk about they've lost their identity. That's how they defined who they are. This not only was my identity, but I lost my community. Almost every relationship I've had, even with the referees in hockey that I know, they're LDS. But it's also my entire belief system.
It's what you've been living for years.
Where do we go when we die? I can't say that I know anymore. And I almost threw out God before I threw out the Mormon church. Because I started to think, if God has a problem with these individuals, I don't want to have anything to do with that God. And if heaven, if eternity means spending time with God, I don't want to be there. If that's what the heaven is, the way you're defining that, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I'll go wherever Jackson's going. I'll be fine with that.
Yeah, because you were focused on the people. You were focused on the loving your neighbor. And
so I became angry when I looked at the truth claims. Pissed me off. All people have known this. This is ridiculous. And it's like, well, they didn't really. You know, maybe they didn't know any of it any better than I did. But the depression, I didn't have anybody to turn to, especially since I'm a man. So few close male relationships. We don't talk about things like this. We talk about sports and business. And
that's what we've been taught.
How are you feeling? I don't even know what to do with that.
Keep that to yourself.
Yeah, just push it down. It'll go away. It's a good thing about feelings is they'll just go away.
And it'll come right back.
But then I also have this reputation of like, well, now they're all seeing me as I'm a pariah. All the work that I put in to try to be the good person, to do the right thing and carry the water and be obedient. And now they're just like, I'm a cautionary tale. I'm like, well, he was just lazy. He lost his testimony. He didn't doubt his doubts. But I also honestly didn't know me, didn't know who I was. I don't know what my favorite food is. I'd never really even considered that. And I think part of that is birth order. In my family of origin, I'm third. What I wanted never really mattered there. What I wanted never really mattered with the church. Who I was didn't matter to anybody. I had never really thought about it. I just accepted what I was told and did what I was told to be who I was told to be. So yeah, I didn't know who I was. So I had the world's softest landing when I left the church. My wife left probably a year or so before I did. Didn't officially leave.
She just checked out.
But
mentally.
She had some concerns. My son, my oldest child, who's my only boy, he served a mission in Africa, and he had already left the church when he came back. He struggled with that for a long time. He does not like what he did in Africa. He doesn't mind being there and helping people, but he does not like the proselyting part of it. And that became a bothersome with him. And he had a lot of triggers earlier on than I did. My daughter was married in the temple. We were all present, and even my son went at the time. My next daughter told us when she was 18, I'm not going back to church anymore. I'm an adult. I don't want to do that. But we've known that since she was 12. So she's like, I'll do it because you're really good people and you want me to, and I'm your daughter. I mean, she's amazing that she just, okay. We knew from her young age, she didn't buy any of this. And then my youngest daughter was still kind of in church and she was kind of thinking about going on a mission. But my wife, when she kind of floated the idea that she was leaving, we have these long conversations in our drives, and she was saying, so I've been thinking a lot about, and she'd bring up a topic, and I could just tell it was hard for her to bring up because I was in it. I was still in it. I was in the bishopric. I'm leading this charge. And she was kind of done with it. And I've seen what that does to families. Fortunately, when I left, I was the last person in my family to leave. My parents, they were never in the church. They never judged me for that. I think they wore it as a badge of pride that I served a mission and all these other things, but they weren't really buying into the system. But I know family who's half of them left. One spouse, a couple of the kids, none of the parents. So they are ostracized in their own family. I didn't have that. I mean, what if you can't have conversations with your own children? I had somebody that I was talking to that says, I didn't realize that when you left the church keeps your family. And I'm like, that's just heartbreaking. After being told that that's the most important thing, family is the most important. We're going to defend it with muskets when we need to.
Protect that family.
Yeah.
But you did.
But yeah, you can't.
In your own way.
You can't be with your family now. Yeah. Yes.
And your family protected you because they had done the things and you were so very lost in that moment. Like you didn't have, who am I? You didn't have the answer to that. You didn't know. You said it was a while. You said it was a couple years of like spiral kind of. Does this feel like, yeah, like emptiness? Is that like, would you describe it as like a lost kind of emptiness?
Yeah, I feel like I had done my whole life building this beautiful garden and with these beautiful walls and plants and colors, and just, it was gorgeous year round. And all of a sudden I'm in a vacuum, not a sound, not a smell, not a sight, nothing. And part of me is like, well, who are you? And that would be the only thing that echoed. I, how do you say you don't know? How are you 50 years old and you don't know who the hell you are?
But did you have the logical part of your mind that kind of takes over and is like, well, you were following all these rules. They were defining who you were. And like, but then your emotional center was very much kind of like, what do I do now? Because I feel like,
yeah.
And the reason I ask that is because like when I, this nothing like your experience, but like when I lost my mom and grieving, and then when I got older, I was like, I logically knew what I needed to do. Like I logically knew what was happening. I logically knew the way out, but I couldn't do it. Like my emotional center was just like, no, we're really messed up right now. Just let that happen. Did you have this balance or was it just total blankness?
So you have all the emotions involved in it of seeing your neighbors that you thought you were really good friends with and them not seeing, and seeing them on a regular basis. We still live in the same place. I'm surrounded by people that don't know me. I'm like, you know me. I've been here 20 years. I'm still me. Not having any of that. And there have been a couple of exceptions, to be fair. I don't want to say that there haven't been. And I didn't do a very good job when I left about explaining myself to the people that I would have considered friends, because I didn't think that they would understand it. I've got my reasons for not doing it. I'm sure they have theirs, and they're equally valid. They're good people. And I don't like throwing rocks at the church because it just hits all the nice people inside. There are some great people in the church. They just don't know any better. They're in the same situation that I was in. But the intellectual side as well, I mean, there's no God. I mean, imagine tomorrow, Matt, you woke up and you knew for sure there was a God.
I need to see proof here.
Okay, so you did. He visits you. You know for a fact.
Yeah.
How does that going to affect your life from that point on?
I would be lost. I don't know. I don't know how.
Yeah, you'd have to reconfigure every thought, relationship, your favorite movie that swears, that takes the name of the Lord in vain, that what you, all this stuff that you're like, okay, whatever, I can see how that's offensive, but it doesn't bother me. Whatever. Now it needs to. I mean, it's all become, so part of the religious deconstruction, and I have these deeper conversations with people that have had religious deconstruction deconstructs everything, because they're just like, well, if we're going to rip shit apart, let's take it all down to the bones, right? So they deconstruct everything, but you have to decide, what you smash it all to pieces, and then you pick up each piece and you have to look at it again and say, what's this love your neighbor thing? I kind of still feel like that resonates with me. But I just don't like the way, and I hear a song that is a famous primary song or something that I've been singing for decades, such a huge trigger. It's just about loving your neighbor. Is it, or is it indoctrination that we're giving to three-year-olds? I don't know what to do with this piece. Is that who I am? What? And it just takes a long time, lots of anger, and a lot of people that leave the church for a long time consider themselves post-Mormon or ex-Mormon or whatever. But I've also learned that you have to deconstruct being LDS or religious, and then you have to deconstruct being ex-religious. Don't just be, let what you're not define you anymore. You've got to get past that part, right? I'm not ex-Mormon anymore. That's not who I am. Who am I? It's taken a while, and I've found some wonderful new friends and connections. I feel like I'm a better human being, even a better Christian, although I don't believe in that, than I've ever been. The work that I'm doing, I work with refugees, I work with the homeless, I work with troubled teens. And what's been so eye-opening to me is the LDS Church, which is huge around here and has more money than any other organization on the planet, they do nothing to help those people. I mentioned Silence. I met him. He lives on the streets, or he did. He doesn't anymore, and was addicted. And the church, all this, I asked him, what's made the difference for you to be able to turn around and do all this stuff? And he gave me five or six things that has helped him so much in his life that he's been able to get back on track. Not one of them had anything to do with the LDS Church. They do not help the homeless. They don't open their church doors when it's freezing outside. All the other churches do. All the other churches have ways of really getting involved with these individuals. The LDS Church sends people on missions and collects tithings and makes big donations, big splashes, but it's less than a tenth of 1% of what their holdings are.
And free labor with the callings.
So much free labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if they actually decided they wanted to end homeless in America, it'd be done tomorrow. It would be done. And as it is, they're not giving them a single meal.
It sounds like you've kind of gravitated to helping the people that were not served by that and
yes.
that were excluded.
Don't help the organization that says that they're doing it. Just go to them. Ask them, what do you need? How can I help?
And I would imagine, does a lot of that stem from that empty period in which you were trying to search of like who you were and how can you, is there a part of you that thinks, how can I like mend this, not mend it, but how can I make up for this?
No, I think part of it was, I mean, I'm still looking at mending relationships with people that are here. I don't know how to do that. I've been very tentative. They've been very tentative. I don't want to do it wrong. I hope it happens, but this has been several years that I've been clearly out and adjusted and still nothing has happened. I haven't reached out. They haven't reached out.
I mean, in your own sense. Like, how do I make up for going down this road? Is there a part of you that thinks that?
I've always, my core value is love. Love your neighbor part, I'm all about that. And when I served in the bishopric, I could walk into any house at any time and say, hey, I hear you're struggling. What can we do to help you? And all of a sudden, I didn't even talk with those people anymore. I still did some coaching a little bit, but it's like, but how do I help people? I thought that's what I was doing, and I really wasn't. Looking at none of that got through to people that mattered is heartbreaking. So it's taken a while, and a lot of the thinking is, what do you like to do? What are you good at? How can you help people the most? What if we made that a full-time position? What if we figured out a way to do that? And I'm not getting paid for all of that. I do some teaching, basically what I do right now. And I'm fortunately in a situation where I can do that, and I have that time. But I think it was just me saying, I need that human connection. And I've become a huge I didn't realize I was a huge feminist. I'm huge LGBTQ advocate. I'm huge with the immigration and new Americans and refugee reforms. And so I've been getting involved in a lot of really neat things with a lot of really neat people. And turns out that I kind of felt like I was doing that all along, but that wasn't what it was at all. I was literally carrying the water for this organization that is poisoning everybody, every drop.
But you were still a good human. And so now you have this opportunity to be a good human on your own terms, on the terms that you create for the world and for you and the people around you. You know, it's not necessarily that you're a feminist or you're just a pro human. Like you want, you know, you want people to have a good life and you want to help them if you can. And you've learned a lot in this kind of tragic experience, right? You know, like you did a lot of good, I'm sure, in those years that you were with the church. Sure, you were carrying the water. Sure, it was, you know, that was just part of the role you were playing. But I don't doubt that you didn't do good work. So there's that piece that kind of just stayed along and then you were able to uncover it and use it in a positive way. Or at least that's how I see it. Because the way you talk about helping these other people and the people that are not in the closed loop, that are not in the space that's familiar with everyone else, I mean, it just shows the type of human that you are and probably always were, because that love thy neighbor was still, you know, sitting in there.
But there's part of me that gave all that attribution to the fact that I was Mormon.
Yeah, well.
It's like, no, that's who you were.
But that was dripped into your water since you were a child.
Yes.
And so, absolutely. You know, that it's not like a fault of you if that's all you knew, you know, and that's really, sure, you saw other things, but you were always brought back to like, no, don't do those other things because XYZ. See, this is how you're going to get there. So, I mean, you're not the only person that's ever been a part of something like that, you know? And so,
no. And as difficult as it is, it's a really interesting gift to find out that I was so phenomenally wrong about something that was so important to my core that I would just smash it into pieces and then decide how I wanted to build it myself. And I think that's been very difficult, but it's also been a really beautiful journey.
Yeah, it's like probably one of the hardest things that anyone can do is to shatter everything you ever knew and believed and followed through with. What would you say is the biggest difference between that version of you and this version of you, and what's the most similar?
I think the biggest difference would be that before I would do everything that was expected of me and that was laid out in front of me, all of the programs, which are good programs, they're designed to be good. And now, but even serving your neighbor, you get assigned people in your neighborhood that you're like their home teacher. And there are two families that you go visit. Every member has this. Every adult is either a home teacher if you're a man or a visiting teacher if you're a woman. There are two other families that live in your area that you're responsible for, that you go visit with them and just check in on them and whatever. If you get a new assignment as a home teacher, you don't go visit your old person anymore. You go visit the other person because you've got a new assignment. You're helping people, but you're helping everything by assignment. And I think the biggest change now is I just go look for people who need it and say, what can I do to help?
Yeah. You lead with your heart.
There's no assignment here. Yeah. And there are all kinds of places to find them. But I think when people are assigned all of these things and they have all these programs, one, they're spending a tremendous amount of time doing it. And two, they don't bother actually looking for any of it on their own because they know on Wednesday night at Young Women's, they're going to do a service project. And they know on Sunday, they're going to be, you know, so they just allow that to happen and kind of get dragged along with it. But they're really missing the people who need help.
That's, I mean, so now you're leading with your heart and not by assignment, even though you were still, you know, using your heart in those assignments, but now you're choosing but what feels the best for you. What's the most similar, or is that also similar?
I think the similar thing is that I love to help people. And I think that the reason it's different is before I thought I like to help people because you were supposed to, and the church let, you know, and that was the spirit telling you that was a good thing. And I'm like, no, That's just who you are. Inside the church, outside the church, you just like to help people.
I can see it. I can see it. I can hear it in your podcast episodes when you're talking to your guests and having these really deep conversations that go into areas that people don't talk about. But now I kind of notice the guests that you do have and why you choose those guests or why they choose you and why they trust you to have these conversations and kind of deconstruct some of the beliefs that they may had and why do they have them. I like to kind of wrap up the calls with a question, and you've probably heard it on other episodes, but I'm wondering if you could go back to the version of you heading off to Japan as a missionary with what you know now. Is there anything that you could whisper in his ear or something that could maybe trigger a change earlier or a different or getting you closer to this version of you earlier in your life?
Yeah. I mean, it really kind of comes down to one question to me. And I don't know if I would have been smart enough to answer it at the time. What do you want to do? What do you want to do?
You would have been smart enough to answer it, but I think your answer would have been related to what you had been
yes.
told.
I want to go on a mission. No. What do you want to do? Why do you want to do that?
Yeah.
You want to help others? Help others.
Do you think that version of you made his own decisions, or were the decisions very much influenced by whatever was you were brought up to believe or feel? And I don't know how to ask that question in the way that I want to, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had this discussion with a couple of different people, and it can be seen a little aggressive, but it's also very, it's true. I mean, is the LDS church a cult? Right. So you look up the definition of what it means to be a cult, and you read those questions, and they're like 9 for 9, which is so weird, because if Mormons were reading another cult's handbook or learning about another cult's thing, they'd say, that's a cult. It's like, well, but if you're brainwashed, would you know it? The answer is no, you wouldn't. You don't know that you've surrendered control until you've stepped away and you can learn about that group from a different perspective. So was that person caught up and able to make all of their own decisions? Absolutely not. You're baptized when you're 8. You made the choice to be baptized. They always say you made the choice to be baptized. They're 8. They didn't make the choice to be baptized. But now I've heard church leaders say, can you walk away? And they'll say, no, you can't, because at the age of 8, you dedicated yourself to. And I'm like, whoa, you never have the chance to walk away. I've interviewed a friend that is a third generation ex-Scientologist. She left Scientology. So much similarity between the two. She signed a 1,000-year contract when she was 14. I'm like, what? And to me, that's like, that's a cult. That's absolutely crazy. Yeah, we did the same thing when we were baptized at 8. We had a party and cake afterwards, so it didn't seem so bad, but
I don't think that's all too different from other religions as well, with the baptisms and what's the other thing called? I can't think of it. I'm such a bad human being. Or maybe a good one in a way.
Yeah,
that
I was going to say, I wouldn't say that.
I find my own path. And, you know, I think going back to that original question, I think you were making decisions that you thought were your own, but they were heavily influenced by what you were told and kind of brought up to do.
Which we all are, religious or not, your family of origin, the community that you're in. If you're from the South, you're going to believe this way. You're going, you know, if you're in a big city or East Coast or red, blue, you've got all these things around you that you don't even realize.
You know, I think the final message here is really like, listen and talk to each other, learn from each other, help each other. To your point, love thy neighbor and the people around you. They're not going to be exactly like you. And that's good. That's good.
Yes.
We should have different perspectives
How
and conversations.
How beautiful is that?
Yeah. And you're doing that with your Strangers You Know podcast. I love hearing some of those conversations and like, wow, people's lives the things we don't know about the people that are all around us, and you're providing that for all of us. So I just appreciate that you took this time and really like educated me on kind of this experience within a church that, you know, is seemingly doing good things in the world of their church, but how it can affect someone when you get really ingrained in that and lose sight of what's around you. So just thank you for being a part of this.
Thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it. I just want to say too, that you are very kind to my past self. With religion, you get caught up in a lot of guilt and shame. And I look back on that past person and say, what an idiot. How could you not? You have, in all of your episodes, you're very kind to the past versions of people, and understanding that, you know, that was what you best you knew at the time. And it took me a long time to come to that awareness and to not be mad at that version of me that should have known better, should have known sooner, whatever. But thank you for that. That is, makes it a lot more palatable, and makes me feel better about it. And thank you for allowing me to take the time to share my story.
Yeah, it's stories are so important, and you're right. I think we're our worst enemies. I mean, that's just a known thing. Like we just like take that shame, but sometimes we just have to go through these moments in our lives, and this is just kind of like what's happening. But what you're doing with your awakening moment is what matters now. You're teaching other people, you're helping other people, you're doing the things that the earlier version of you was thought they were doing, right? You know, and now you've just had this new awakening, and you're better because of that experience. You are doing better things than you could without those experiences, I believe. So thank you for doing that for the world and the people around you. And what you're going to be doing in the future, I think, is going to be fascinating. And we will share the link to your podcast and your website in the show notes so that people can connect with you and just be a part of your world. So thank you again.
Thank you. I know my listeners, we have fairly similar goals in our podcast, which is kind of what drew me to you in the first place. So thank you for doing what you're doing as well. I love hearing the stories and hearing how people take these life shifts and move forward with their lives and get the most out of what they've been and what they've experienced and move forward with the best of it. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that. And if you are listening and you feel the same way, I know Brian agrees with this, but we would love 5-star ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. If it does nothing else, it makes us have a good day whenever we see that. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with a brand new episode. For more information, please visit www.thelifeshiftpodcast.com.